Education and Workforce Committee in the Senate. If you're in the wrong place, now's your chance to leave, or you can stick around and enjoy the fun. We actually have a very informative meeting this afternoon. I would like to remind all of you that if you have cell phones, to please put them on vibrate so we do not have to hear them. We're going to start in with our informational meeting first up, and we have an overview of the Oregon University system. And in the front row, I would like you to come forward, George Pernsteiner and Tim Nesbitt. And is okay. And gentlemen, if you would state your name and your affiliation, please. I appreciate
Thank you. Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Pernsteiner. I'm the acting chancellor of the Oregon University System, and I'm joined today by one of our Oregon State Board of Higher Education members, Tim Nesbitt. Because Tim is time constrained in his ability to be here today, we will change our order of speaking just a little bit, and I hope at the end to draw back all the threads so that they weave together. The Oregon University System, as you know, has 7 campuses and about 80,000 students, more than 80,000 students. And one of the things that's happened in the last year is that the Board of Higher Education has almost all new members. And those new members embarked on an ambitious work plan that was divided among several working groups. And that work plan focused on student success, both with respect to the ability of students to come to colleges and universities to be able to afford to, and with respect to their success both in the community colleges and at the universities. And Tim Nesbitt, who chairs our Affordability and Access Working Group, is here to speak a little bit about what that group has done in order to make the promise of college and university education affordable for every Oregonian.
Thank you, George. Chair Walker, members of the committee, as you heard, I've been co-chairing the Higher Ed Board's work group on access and affordability. And we began...
You're going to begin by telling us your name.
My name is Tim Nesbitt, as Mr. Pernsteiner told you, and I'm a member of the Higher Ed Board.
Thank
you. And as I said, co-chair of our work group on access and affordability. Since I assumed my position on the board, practically very soon thereafter, we convened a number of work groups, mine on the challenge of making our higher education system more affordable, and we confronted first the fact that, unfortunately, for 2 successive reports, the so-called measuring up reports, we unfortunately have rated an F on affordability, and in the last report, even a worse F than we had 2 years prior. In part because, you know, when you compare us to other states, we have slightly lower than average family incomes. That's a small part of it. We also have, depending on the institution you're looking at, either slightly higher or much higher than average tuition at our public colleges and universities. But by far the greatest cause of this affordability gap is that as a state, we contribute a lot less in the form of need-based financial aid than do other states around the country, by magnitudes of like 1/4 or 1/3 of what Washington State and California do, our neighbors. So we looked at that, and we looked at the vehicle which the state currently has used for need-based financial aid, namely the Urban Opportunity Grant, and concluded that with some modifications there, we could make that program more effective, expand it so that we reach more students. Over the long term, we're looking at following the model of the Pell Grant, which takes into account both a family's assets as well as its income, but also allows for kind of sloping assistance. Instead of what we have now, we reach a cliff, and with another dollar of income, you're no longer able to receive any Oregon Opportunity Grant. In the future, we'd like to get to more of a sloping system where, with a little bit of higher income, you still get some assistance, because we want to both remove and mitigate the financial barriers for low-income and even low-middle-income families. With that, we set to work on a model for reforming our Oregon Opportunity Grant, and then we had the nice problem of having to construct an interim proposal with $91.6 million in the budget that you received from governor for 05-07. And we were able to do that, though, not just by looking at it in isolation, but by trying to come up with a proposal that was consistent with the kinds of changes we want to make over time in the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And you have in the handout, I believe it's the last page, an outline of what we and the Student Assistance Commission, and I think even more significantly, the community colleges, the Oregon Student Association, and our private college association have all agreed is the best next step for allocating the Oregon Opportunity Grant, restructuring it, and taking, I think, a very important next step. It's an incremental step, but a very significant one, towards closing that affordability gap for our students. And you see here that we would, at this point, provide the commitment to the Oregon Opportunity Grant extending to all students who apply, not having a cutoff date on the calendar because we're out of money. And right now we have these kinds of moving cutoff dates for the private colleges and the public, depending on when they run out of money. This allocation you see here would meet one of our first priorities, is to provide this Oregon Opportunity Grant for students who apply year-round. Secondly, a restructuring, which allows us over time to put more money into assistance for students who choose to attend a community college or a public institution, four-year college, and you see the amounts here, which are significantly more for our community college and OUS institutions than for the private institutions. Nonetheless, there's a maintenance of effort here for the privates as well, which is what allows them to join with us in recommending these changes to you. Over time, if we continue to improve the grant, continue to keep the private institutions part of the grant process, and recognize their maintenance of effort and continue to match that, we have a win-win-win scenario here for all of our institutions, the community colleges, the public universities, and the private colleges. Secondly, we know that one of the big obstacles to enrollment is that sticker shock of tuition. Sure, there may be an Oregon Opportunity Grant which you can apply for, there may be various scholarships and maybe fee remissions, but that first number a student or a student's family sees can be the one that really sets them back and makes them think it's not possible to take that next step and enroll. We've looked at best practices of states around the country and have found that sometimes first-time grant for a newly enrolling student can be the most cost-effective way to overcome the sticker shock of what looks like a high rate of tuition. And consequently, we're able to recommend to you that for that purpose, and for the purpose of linking our higher education system more to the preparatory work that is done in our high schools, for a fairly modest total amount of money, this item is only about a $2 million item, we'd be able to offer a $500 preparedness grant or challenge grant to students who qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant and have completed the Certificate of Initial Mastery. So in other words, they're better prepared for college. So we're providing that extra incentive to become better prepared and to enable those who are better prepared to overcome that that sticker shock. That $500 amount has been found in other states to be quite significant, to kind of carry a symbolic and important value. And lastly, this will be of assistance especially to our community college students to extend the eligibility to part-time students. Currently, it's something that the Oregon Opportunity Grant was designed to do, but OSAC's never had enough money to do it. And if we recognize the fact that there's a lot of students working their way through college now, it takes a lot more hours of work to work your way through college now. Our community colleges are often the venue for students who are working their way through college. This will reward the effort of part-time students as well. And all told, if you put all these things together, we estimate that we'd be serving with Oregon Opportunity Grants another 24,700 students over and above those served in the current biennium, and all of those students would be entitled to at least slightly higher grants in the coming biennium. So we are very pleased to be able to recommend this as a first step towards restructuring the Oregon Opportunity Grant, closing that affordability gap, and eventually getting us out of that category of states with an F that rank with an F on affordability, and really get us to the point where cost should not be a overwhelming deterrent to our students in this state who are willing and able and want to go on to get a higher education. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morsett.
Thank you. Tim, that was a great overview, and I congratulate you for doing what you've done. Between the 01 and 03 session, I spent the interim working on a task force made up of college presidents and the business community and so on. And one of the persons complained about all of the past studies that were dropped down the well and never to be seen again. Did you look in the well and pull out some of the past studies and to build upon, or is this started from scratch, or what?
We did. We looked back to studies going back to the early 90s, I remember.
Good.
As well as surveying, as I said, best practices in other states. So we're pretty confident we have an idea for what works best.
Okay, good.
And that's what we're recommending, Senator.
Follow up, please. Well, I think that's great, because I know that we did spend a lot of time talking about, and that included private colleges. The other part of this, which I think is great, and I did have a bill at one point that would have awarded K-12 students, I think it was $150 or $250 for each STEM that they passed, and when they got out of high school, if they passed them all, they would have a $1,500 head start, and that never got anywhere. But it's a good idea. Now, you mentioned $500.
Senator, we agree it's a good idea. So it's packaging some aid in that fashion to, I wouldn't say it's rewarding merit, but it's rewarding effort and preparation.
Well, it does give an incentive for people to take
Definitely.
It seriously and parents to take it seriously. So I think that's a great part of it. Good. Thank you.
We agree, Senator. And if I might add, you'll probably be getting a separate report from OSAC, because the last session, in the last session, they were charged with going out and reviewing the structure of their grant. And they'll be bringing that report back to you, which I think was a product of a lot of public hearings and a lot of work on their behalf. And basically, the restructuring of the grant they recommend is where we are hoping to get to over time, and these changes are consistent with where they want to go.
One more.
Another question? Sure.
Did you remind our speakers that this is an acronym-free zone? It's an AFZ. That's an acronym for acronym-free zone.
Thank you, Senator.
Is that one that you just mentioned?
The Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and I should have said earlier that I'm the president of the Oregon American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations.
Thank you. Mr. Nesbitt, I have a question for you. I'm intrigued about the working group. I get the sense that the working groups did not exist prior to the restructuring of the higher ed board. Is that something that came about with restructuring?
Madam Chair, yes. I'm not positive there weren't working groups in the earlier board, but these working groups really worked hard, and put a lot of effort into it.
Yeah, I'm going to have some questions for the Chancellor later, and I know you're under time constraints to ask him how the new board has been operating with restructuring, because I have great concerns about whether we've seen any financial benefit to that. And so I'm pleased to hear that the working groups are actually working hard. And, you know, that's not to say that the previous board didn't do their work either, but I think this idea of working groups addressed to specific need areas is very worthwhile. It seems to produce this great set of ideas. Wouldn't you agree?
I would, Madam Chair, and I think you're going to be hearing also about the effort we made right after we took our seats on the board. Measure 30 failed. And we managed to time some very important restructurings in the Chancellor's office, which saved us money and was and enabled us not to increase the tuition rates any further in the wake of the failure of Measure 30, and also allowed us to free up some money to provide for mitigation of tuition increases in the current academic year. And both of those efforts I'm proud of, because I think they really did produce for you. They identified savings and put them where they needed.
And I, Mr. Nesbitt, I didn't know you could get any worse than an F, but I guess it's an F.
There were rankings within the F category, Senator, and we went backwards. We went the wrong direction within the F category, unfortunately.
I never got an F in school, so I'm very disappointed that we're getting an F for our higher education system, because that doesn't bode well. So I'm hoping we're turning it around. Does the committee have any other questions, Senator Decker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One related to on the opportunity grant. I'm interested in a flat grant, and at least was led to believe that could occur through rulemaking. And I don't know. Perhaps I need to alter my thinking and think it might take legislative action. If that's the case, then I'm interested in doing that. But my understanding was we were going to be going towards a flat grant with opportunity grant. between publics and privates, but I don't see that represented, at least in the short term here. And I did come in late, so maybe you mentioned that that's where we're headed.
That's where we're headed. And if we could get to the point where we're matching the effort of other states, we would, in fact, have a grant for our public four-year institutions, which would be the same as for our private four-year institutions. What we're trying to do is get there over time by approaching it from a maintenance of effort for the privates and adding the incremental increases to the publics. So actually, the amounts here, the rate of increase is much greater for our OUS four-year institutions and our two-year community colleges than for the privates. And eventually, the idea is if we get the level up, it'll subsume all of the conflicts between the privates and the publics in the interim. And that's the approach which enables me to say we have consensus from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, from the Community College Association, from the Oregon Student Association, and from the private college group.
Well, yeah, and I know, Madam Chair, this ruffles some feathers, but for me, the sooner that we could get there, I just look at the maintenance of effort, and I'm trying to calibrate in my mind how long it will take before we're at, I guess, an equilibrium. And to me, it would be, since it's double in 05-06, it's going to be quite some time. And I think my interest would be to punch the accelerator a little bit. And perhaps that's a legislative decision. That's one that we would have to really weigh in on. But it's one that I'd be interested in weighing in on, if that's the case, to really get us to equilibrium quicker amongst the privates and the public. And I do know that this is a touchy subject.
And we certainly have discussed it at length in our work groups. Eventually, all parties, as I said, came to agreement that this was the best next step, including the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So we did reach agreement with them, and you know, it's a balance of interest, Senator, as I'm sure you know. That's your job to do that. But we feel good about the balance we reached in this recommendation.
And Madam Chair, so the other effort, and I know you can't speak directly for the governor in terms of a constitutional dedicated funding source for affordability for higher education, are we now, and I think I would be supportive of this, now going to put most of our energy and efforts into the Opportunity Grant as the vehicle to achieve that, or is that a continuing effort to look at? Is the board, I guess, going to continue to look at maybe perhaps a constitutional amendment and finding a revenue source that would create the corpus?
Senator, the recommendations here for how to spend the $91.6 million for the Opportunity Grant are consistent also with what we hope to accomplish over time to create a endowed fund that could then be used. So we would, so ideally 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, we wouldn't be coming back to you every session for an allocation in the budget to get us there. We would have built a fund in addition, which whose principal could generate the earnings we would need to maintain this over time. That's a large order, but it's a goal which we'll be better able to estimate in when we see what other sources of funding might emerge in the next few biennia.
Next Cuba.
Well, and I agree we need a plan. the same thing with K-12, that Quality Education Commission, the QEM, the Quality Education Model, that's got a number out here of over $7 billion. It's so far removed from where we're at today that I'm looking at developing a 10-year plan to get us a little bit each year so people feel like they're making progress and that they're not coming here to the Capitol and holding out their tin cup. And it's the same way with higher ed. I'm so glad my children are done. They're now they both want to go on to graduate school.
Right.
Like, oh, no, because it's so expensive. And I work in bankruptcy court and see a lot of students coming in with big loans. But I do know that the Opportunity Grant is real pivotal. I've never been given the opportunity to go to college without it. It was called the Oregon Need Grant then. It was invented, it was created shortly before I began my work at the U of O, and I would have never gotten a degree. and completed it without it. It is so critical for low-income students. So I appreciate your work very much.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. Chancellor, you want to take it away?
All right. Thank you.
Excuse me. I have to leave.
Be excused.
Thanks. Again, for the record, Chair Walker, members of the committee, George Pernsteiner with the Oregon University System. As I mentioned earlier, the Oregon University System serves more than 80,000 students. That was our fall term regular credit headcount, which is the highest in our history. We have about 2,500 regular faculty, and we are about a $2.2 billion a year enterprise, of which about 17%, a very important 17%, or about $345 million a year, comes from state appropriation. We receive about $300 million a year from the federal government and private sources in terms of research grants, and another roughly $150 million a year is raised for specific purposes by the universities and their foundations in terms of philanthropic support. So there are a variety of fund sources for the universities, some of which are focused specifically on things that cannot be paid for in any other way, such as federal research, and some of which, in fact, like the state appropriation and like tuition, are used to support the education of students. We have seven universities. Each of them has a different mission. Each of them has a different size. They are located in various parts of the state, and at various times over the course of the session, I'm sure you will be able to talk with members from the faculty and administrations and student bodies of each of these institutions. But overall, we are a successful enterprise, and we are poised, I think, to help Oregonians meet the challenges of a 21st century global information-based society. That's an important set of words, I think, because it indicates both the kind of an economy and society which we will be in, and the competition which we will face, which will come not just from other states, but also from throughout the world. And it requires of us a level of education and a level of commitment that, in fact, is greater than perhaps we have had to face in the past, of all of us. So for that reason, we in the Oregon University System are focusing more intently than ever on the performance that we have with respect to key measurements that would indicate to you and to us and to the people of the state what it is we value, what it is we're trying to achieve. In the handout which you have, in the first of the packet on the second page, is an insert which shows our performance and accountability framework. And you'll probably see a lot more of this over the course of the next several months. We'll be talking about affordable access. You heard Director Nesbitt speak about the work of the Access and Affordability Work Group, and I'm going to come back to that in a bit. But that is one of the areas for which we are developing key benchmarks to determine how well we are doing in meeting the needs of Oregonians in terms of the affordability of what we offer. Student progress, the ability of our institutions and our students to work together to ensure that students move towards degrees as rapidly and successfully as is possible. The quality of our education, which rests fundamentally upon the quality of our faculty and the quality of our student bodies. And finally, the economic and civic contributions which are made by the universities and by their graduates and by the research that is done. We'll keep coming back to those things over the course of probably this entire session, but those are the things that we will focus on. I want to focus briefly on student success because that's perhaps the measure for which we intend to be known the best. This year we will award at our seven colleges and universities more than 18,000 degrees and certificates. 18,000 Oregonians will have their lives changed for the better by those degrees and certificates this year, and that's 5,000 more than we awarded even 5 or 6 years ago. And that shows the impact of the investment which this body made in the Oregon University System in the 1999 session, when we increased the focus on higher education and increased then the number of students whom we could serve. And you're beginning now to see the impact of that. because the level, the number of graduates each year is now about 5,000 higher than the 13,000 with which we had been accustomed in the late 90s. So we're about 18,000 a year now and continuing to grow in terms of graduation. Our retention rates over the last several years have been improving, and they've been improving at every one of our colleges and universities. They're not as good as we want them. They need to improve more, but in fact we are focusing on that. Our graduation rates, similar, are improving. They're not where we want them, but nonetheless, we are continuing to work on that. We are continuing to make progress, and we intend to continue to do so. Part of the way that you do that is through the work of the faculty, and part of the way that you do that is through the work of advising. And one of the things which I hope that you will get a chance to see later this afternoon is a demonstration by both University of Oregon and Portland State University on an articulated articulated transfer linked audit system, which will... Did I get that right?
I think you did. I remember writing that down.
That will show then a snapshot for any student, any hour of day and night, as to not only what she or he has taken at community colleges or Oregon University schools, but also what she or he still needs to take in order to get the degree that she or he wants from the institution of choice. That's an important improvement, if you will, using technology to make sure that that student then and the student's advisor have a template for success. And that's an important improvement that will be demonstrated to you later this afternoon. Another important thing is affordability. Director Nesbitt talked about the Oregon Opportunity Grant. In addition to that, we've tried, and we will talk in a little bit about making tuition increases less stark, less large than they were in the prior biennium, and in fact that we are beginning to focus more and more on debt counseling for our students at every one of our seven colleges and universities.
Oh, excuse me, Chancellor, would you back up and repeat that, please?
Every one of our colleges and universities now is offering one kind or another of debt counseling as part of the work that it does with students. And I have here the handout. I can give you the handouts afterwards of what each of them is doing. I'm going to ask now all of them then to share those with one another in order to come up with some best practices that we might be able to use. And I think that's...
So let me just clarify, because this is as you know, I've mentioned this to you before, it's an area of grave concern to me. So as at some point the students, as they're working their way through their 4 years or 5 years or however long it takes, at what point do you sit down with them and say, look, it's going to cost you this much to graduate, provided the legislature doesn't keep increasing your tuition. Actually, we don't do that. The university system does that because we don't fund you properly. But at what point along the way and how often along the way are you giving this guidance so that they can retool maybe their career plans?
And it varies from campus to Chair Walker, member of the committee. It varies from campus to campus. At every campus... there is an initial, like an orientation. In some of the campuses, it's part of a course that they offer to all freshmen at a couple of the campuses. It's subsumed within that in order to help them acclimate to the whole college experience. And part of that deals with budgeting and debt, because more and more students graduate now with higher and higher debt loads. And that's a national phenomenon, as well as one that is occurring here. What we intend to do now that I have what each of the seven are doing is to ask them to share their information together to see if we can come up with some best practices. There are some other times during the course of study that if they do take out loans, there is additional communication at that point in time. And so the question then is, what is the best way to ensure that students can get through their college experience with as, you know, and essentially come out with as little debt as possible? One of the things we're looking at also is, does it make sense to look at debt consolidation at the end of college? Is that something that makes sense? It may in some cases, it may not in others. There's a whole variety of things to be looked at that the financial aid offices look at, as well as the students themselves. So that's part of the work, then, that we hope to be doing prior to the start of the next school year, is to see what things can we do at each of the institutions based on what the others are doing.
And, Chancellor, I'm really pleased that you are doing that, because it just is so critical in the high cost of education right now for students to be sure they're on the right track. And what's amazing to me is that when I need to go buy a car, let's just say I'm going to go buy a car, and I go to my credit union or my bank and get financing, they're going to look at my credit report. They're going to look at my ability to repay the loan before they agree to give me the loan. But when a student goes to college and plans their tenure through the system, nobody stops to talk to them about it, or apparently they have not in the past. And I think that's irresponsible. And as you will notice in our committee schedule coming up, I don't think we have it posted, but we're going to have a whole 2-hour hearing on financial illiteracy. Actually, financial literacy, because we are financially illiterate in our country. And part of that just blends in with what you're talking about here. So I really would like you to continue to do work on that and report back to us at the legislature how you're doing and how well the students are receiving that information.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another focus on student success deals with transfer. The transfer of credits among the 24 public post-secondary colleges and universities in the state, 17 community colleges and the 7 Oregon University System campuses. You'll have a demonstration or a discussion a little bit later about the Oregon Transfer Module, which was developed this past fall by the faculties at the community colleges and the Oregon University System jointly in order to provide to community college, well, students at any of the 24 institutions, a template for how in 1 year they can take courses wherever they are and make sure that those courses all will transfer to meet the general education requirements of the 23 other community colleges and four-year schools in the state. The importance of this, then, is that it becomes transparent to the student, it becomes clear to the student what it is that she or he needs to do, and the institutions will recognize those credits and count them towards the general education requirements of the degree. We also are focusing more and more on high school AP classes and on bottleneck courses within the university, and all of this is being done under the auspices of yet another of the Board of Higher Education work groups, the one on excellence in delivery and productivity, chaired by Gretchen Schutte, the president of Temecula Community College.
Chancellor, could I interrupt you for a moment? Is there anywhere in our materials where it lists all of the work groups that you have?
Good question.
I don't see it.
I may have neglected to do that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I would just ask that you could give us that information.
Okay.
I would like to know what you're all working on.
There are three of the work groups, and you've heard about the one, Access and Affordability, from Director Nesbitt, which is focused on trying to improve Oregon's grade from F to something better than F in terms of affordability. And they, in fact, spent a lot of the time that I think led to the proposal that you have in the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget for the doubling of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And Director Nesbitt talked a little more about that. That is, though, one step in a long journey. And that journey will help meet the affordability requirements of the whole state. The dream of that work group is to make a college or university education affordable to every Oregonian, so that Oregonians from birth will believe that they can, in fact, go to college, that it can be something that they can think about, that they can aspire to, without having automatically to think, well, I can't afford that. And part of what that working group is doing is to make sure that that view of the world is instilled throughout the state. The Excellence in Delivery and Productivity Work Group, which is focusing on the Oregon Transfer Module, on the articulated audit system, which you can see, on improving the access for advanced placement courses in high school that, in fact, will count towards college credit, and now on focusing on the bottleneck courses at both the community colleges and the universities. Those are the courses that if you need to get a degree, you have to have that particular class, and you can't get it because it isn't offered that term, or it's full that term. Those are the bottleneck courses. Those are the courses that keep students from making progress to their degrees in a timely fashion because they're full or they're not offered at that institution at that in that particular term. So what the Excellence in Delivery and Productivity Working Group is now working with the provosts and the of the university system and the instructional administrators of the community colleges to come up with ways of having each other help meet those bottleneck classes, having the individual universities and community colleges take a look at their scheduling, finding ways to make it more readily available for students to move through to degrees more rapidly.
I have a question about that, if I might.
Yeah.
Would you envision in this new system that we're going to get a demonstration of soon, would you envision that if a student, for instance, my daughter, when she was at the University of Oregon, found out late in her senior year that she needed a class to graduate. Well, she was doing her internship her last term in Spain, so the only option to take the class was summer while she was in Spain or to come back the following fall for one class. It was a very expensive lesson, and she had to come back next fall for that one class. Are you envisioning that someone in that situation could maybe go to another university and take that one class that may be transferable and still be registered and still graduate from the institution she's registered in, which was the University of Oregon?
Chair Walker, that might be a possibility. There may be others as well in individual instances. And I can't speak for an individual instance here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm focusing now on sort of the larger measure of looking. But the other thing that happens when you have a better advising system,
mm-hmm,
is that you have the opportunity to have a conversation with your advisor and begin to make some trade-offs that may have allowed the conversation she needed to have to have occurred earlier so that courses could have been substituted at that point in time or taken at that point.
Right. My other question would be the sequence classes. And I remember, mm-hmm, all of us who've gone to the university, Econ 101, 201, or 201, 202, 203. What happens if you miss 202 winter term? Because you couldn't get in, or B, you were sick, had to drop out because you needed to work. So then when do you get to take 202? You got to wait until next winter. So those are other issues, too, that I think add to the cost of an education for students. And hopefully you're going to address those with this new system.
Chair Walker, we are addressing those, whether or not they're with the system. That, in fact, is a situation, and if you look at the larger of the campuses, what often happens is they will have sort of a catch-up class in the subsequent term. But each of those things, we would have to look at that particular instance.
Okay.
But overall, the focus from the working group has been, let's find a way without diluting academic quality. In other words, maintaining academic quality, let us find a way to help students move through to degrees more effectively and more quickly than we've been able to in the past. As I said before, we are improving on those measures already. I think with the focus that the presidents, the provosts, and the board working group are bringing to this matter, we'll begin to see even greater improvement as we move into the future. Another working group, third one, remember, Excellence Delivery and Productivity dealt with the transfer module and the audit system. Affordability and Access dealt with the opportunity grant and affordability. A third one is the Academic Excellence and Economic Development Group. They have a more long-term focus. They, in fact, are looking at those investments which could be made using the talent of our university students and faculty to help us spur the economic development of the state. And in fact, you will see in the budget proposal from the governor $2 million in order to help commercialize intellectual property through what our board member Kirby Dias calls the valley of death before a venture capitalist wants to touch it. The point of all of that is to say that we are taking the work that is being done in our university laboratories and research projects, done by our students and our faculty and our staff, and beginning to figure out ways to help that work jumpstart our economy of 5 and 10 years out. That's what the focus of this group is. They are not as far along in their work as the other two groups because theirs has a much longer term and much less focus agenda to it. But basically, those are the three major working groups. Those are the things that they focused on. In addition, the board recently has asked to do some long-range planning, to look at the role of the university system as we look at a pre-K through 20 continuum up to 20 years out. What kind of Oregon will we be in? What kind of Oregon will we want to be? What will it take for our universities to provide the kind of educated citizenry and workforce that we will need in 2025, and what steps should the universities be taking between now and then in order to make that come true? I spoke a bit about the working groups. Let me talk briefly about the Chancellor's Office reorganization. Director Nesbitt mentioned that briefly in his comments because he mentioned that the board, when it first took over, was about a year ago, was able to reorganize the Chancellor's Office in order to focus it more on policy, advocacy, accountability, and not on gatekeeping or service provision. So what's happened is that the board has decentralized authority to campuses to offer programs and services in the ways that they deem appropriate to meet the needs of their students and of their communities in the most effective ways that they believe possible, but with accountability to the board for outcomes and for fiscal soundness. And this requires changes not only in the Chancellor's Office and the campuses, but it may involve, at some point in future, some changes in state legislation as we move forward as well. And there may be one of those bills before one of the other committees now on legal services as an indication of that. The savings that the board was able to achieve through the Chancellor's Office reorganization last year was about $3 million a year. And that savings was used in 2004-05 to reduce the amount of tuition increase that would have been charged on the various campuses. They call it tuition mitigation, and it was the tuition mitigation plan of the board to use the savings from the Chancellor's Office reorganization towards meeting affordability needs for students. Those savings then were included or taken away as part of the reduction in the budget that you'll see before you in the governor's recommended budget. So those savings are no longer available to the board, but they use them in 2004-05 to reduce the tuition at the various colleges and universities.
Chancellor Prince-Denner, do you have a document that shows us everything you did to save $3 million?
We can provide that.
I think I'll probably get that in my Ways and Means Budget Committee at some point.
I think it's in the phase two.
Phase two, yeah. We're getting close to getting into phase two, I think. We have to lead through OHSU's notebooks first. But I think this committee might like to see that because I have concerns about where the money was saved and
sure. What
was done with it. I know you did more than just tuition mitigation. Did you spend the money in other places besides just mitigate tuition?
Chair Walker, part of the money from the first year, I guess it was in 2003-04, was used to meet the Measure 30 cuts that Director Nesbitt talked about.
Okay.
And then the 2004-05 was then used for tuition mitigation. But we have a compendium of dollars that can show.
Okay, thank you.
Much of the change also involved transfers from the Chancellor's Office to various of the universities. The Information Technology Services Group was transferred to Oregon State University. The Southwest Oregon Community College or Center, Southwest Oregon College Center, University Center, was transferred to Eastern Oregon University, and the OPAID I'm trying to remember now that I didn't know we were acronym free. The Oregon College of Advanced Technology Education was transferred to Portland State University.
Oh, we don't have Rosie the Pig here to put your dollars in, so you do have a little freedom there, but we do try to let people know what those acronyms mean.
Yes, no, I understand. But it took me a minute because I haven't seen OKATE spelled out in about 15 years.
That was good, actually. Right in line.
Right now, we are in the middle of a review of both the Controller's Division and the Human Resources Division, and we haven't finalized those reviews yet, so those operations will be changed some prior to the start of the next biennium. Perhaps the most noticeable of the changes which was made was the creation of the Provost Council, which is a council of the seven chief academic officers of the seven colleges and universities. These chief academic officers now, together, are working to develop the academic programs for the state, and they are the new gatekeepers for academic quality instead of the chancellor's office staff playing that role. Many of the academic affairs office functions that were done centrally have been moved. Some were transferred to the Provost Council, some were transferred to Eastern Oregon University or Portland State University. Some, though, have been retained. The functions for diversity, teacher education, community college liaison, and graduate program review remain with the Chancellor's Office and will continue to remain with the Chancellor's Office under the current proposal from the Board. There will also be a whole variety of new financial policies and requirements, the first of which were adopted by the Board last fall. At almost every one of our Board meetings, there are new financial policies put in place in order to deal with the decentralization of authority to the campuses, yet with accountability back to the Board. What does that mean operationally, then? What kinds of requirements for reporting and monitoring will occur? And this will occur not just in the financial policies, which historically have been much more centralized, but also with respect to performance on a variety of other measures, which we've mentioned before, with regard, for example, to retention or degree completion or any of the other focus areas for individual campuses that meet with those four performance areas I mentioned that were on the fold-out from your first handout. In addition, we will be beefing up our internal audit staff in order to ensure that as decentralization of authority occurs, that in fact it occurs in a way that the Board can be assured that things are done properly in accordance with state law and policy. Our 05-07 budget initiatives, very briefly, we recognize that our essential budget level was not able to be fully funded. But we are still focused on four things that are important to the Board and animated the discussion of its working groups. Affordability. Tuition moderation will be a key in the 05-07 biennium, with holding tuition increases to an average of no greater than 7% in the first year and no greater than 5% in the second on average across the campuses. And you heard what Director Nesbitt said about the Oregon Opportunity Grant increase, more than doubling the amount of grant money available to the lowest income students in the state. In access, we will continue to have enrollment growth in the 05-07 biennium, and you will see a demonstration on both Atlas and the transfer module. On excellence, there is an investment in faculty salaries in the coming budget. In economic development, there is an investment in the Oregon Nanoscience and Materials Institute, ONAMI, of $7 million, $21.7 million for the Engineering Technology Investment Council, and as I mentioned before, $2 million for commercializing intellectual property. And finally, for capital construction, we have a $600 million deferred maintenance problem in the state system. The governor is proposing that $83 million be made available to help address that, the biggest single infusion of monies for that in our history. We also have a joint proposal with Brooklyn Community College to build a center in Medford for Southern Oregon Road. We do have some warning signals on the horizon, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention this. In 1994, we had 60,000 students, but we had more faculty than we do today in terms of regular faculty when we have 80,000 students. We have, as I said, $600 million of deferred maintenance, and our faculty salaries are among the lowest 30% in the country. Those are warning signals, in addition to the affordability. But in the discussions which we will be having with you and with the Ways and Means Committee and with others over the course of this session, we'll be talking about dealing with many of these, at least starting to. The $83 million investment in deferred maintenance starts to make a dent in that $600 million problem. The $1 million towards faculty salary improvements will help start that journey. And the Oregon Opportunity Grant, doubling that, will make a great deal of difference. This is a long journey. We believe it's going to take a long time. I think Chair Walker mentioned she's talking about 10-year plans in other parts of the education continuum. I think we, too, will have to be in those kinds of time frames in order to make the kinds of improvements we will need in order to provide for Oregonians quality education that, in fact, will make them competitive in this state with anyone in the world. So at that point, I think I ran too long. Thank you.
Well, no, I appreciate your testimony today. I thought it was really important. It was very good, forthright, and you're right. We need a plan. The students of this state, I think you said it earlier, every Oregonian that's born in this state should know that they, too, can go to a college or a university and become educated and not get into debtor's prison on the way there. And we can't get there without a plan. Coming here to the legislature every biennium to ask for the money we need to work for that biennium just doesn't work. We have to be much more farsighted than that, much more detailed in how we're going to get there. I still have to tell you, I have some concerns about accountability with your decentralized structure of the board or the chancellor's office, putting this all in the hands of the provost. I mean, they're a fine group of people, but what I'm concerned about preserving is someone who really looks out to make sure that we are avoiding duplication in academic programs, that we are continuing to build those intersector relationships or bridges between high schools and community colleges and universities, and I'm not sure who is doing that now, whether it's the provost or the remainder of your staff. So I just want to be sure that people aren't just protecting their own turf and that we are looking at what's being offered at the various universities and seeing if maybe we can concentrate those things at one or two locations and emphasize what they really excel at. Are all of our universities liberal arts colleges? Are we scientific colleges? I mean, let's be clear where we're going. When I was a student going to the University of Oregon, when I was looking for colleges, I didn't want to go to OIT because that was a technical college. So, you know, that was my impression of what OIT is. But OIT is much more than that now. They are developing allied health programs and all kinds of neat things. So each university in the system and each community college offers some really special opportunities for Oregonians. And I think your interest is the same as ours, that we just want to make sure every Oregonian has that opportunity. So does anyone have any questions of the chancellor? We're going to move into the...
I have one.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. I just... one question, and it pops into mind partly from the last sentence that you had, or one of the last sentences, which is the 2% increase, which you'll be happy to know you've been labeled as one of the big winners with a 2% increase. And, Madam Chair, in some ways that's the nature of my question is as we look out, and we've discussed this a little bit, Chancellor, as we look out into the out years, our state has become more dependent on federal transfers that are undoubtedly, actually as we speak, being cut because of the federal budget deficit and the priorities that they have, because they're mainly health care transfers that are unsustainable over time. And so I think particularly about higher education and how we know what happened in the 90s with higher education in terms of the budget percentage that went at the beginning of the decade and went to higher education at the end of the decade. And to me, if I could create a new working group, and I know I have no authority and this will never happen, it would be investing in excellence as the fourth working group. Because I think the Oregonian series that they just ran on higher education really pointed towards the choices that we've avoided in this state and the choices I think your leadership, the board may take up. And I think it's a better place for that discussion with the board than with, frankly, with the legislature, given the continuity and the real focus you have. The question that I have is do you feel that it's sustainable over the long term? When you look at the state budget picture, you look at the structure of our universities and the number of universities that we have, can we continue with the current structure of seven universities? And now, I'm glad you're in between me and former Senator Bryant, because I know now we're thinking of expanding a campus in Bend, which to me, given the fiscal reality that we're in and the desire to invest in excellence, knowing that we have to compete globally now in our higher education system, we have to be thinking, how do we use these limited resources, especially those state ones that have been on the decline, how do we use those limited resources? And hopefully we can grow them, but I'm not sure if I'm terribly, terribly optimistic, but hopefully we can, and the governor's provided. How do we use those to ensure that we're getting excellence and not doing what Oregon historically has done, which is really been big on expansion, but not focused on the excellence quotient of it.
Chair Walker, Senator Deckert, thank you for the question. Thank you for the question, because it gives me a chance to talk about lots of different things all in the same breath. I think we will, in fact, be faced with the necessity for increased and consistent investment in the future by the state in future biennia. I have no doubt of that. But I know that for us to succeed as a state, that we have to find a way to do two things and to do them well. And they will seem to be contradictory. So just bear with me for a second. The first thing is, we have to find a way to provide every Oregonian with an opportunity for a post-secondary education. As Tim said earlier, as I said earlier, because the foundation of our society and economy in 10 to 15 years will demand that. And we do not want to disadvantage our own children in that state that we will call home in 10 to 15 years. But the second thing is, it doesn't do them a whole lot of good if the opportunity which we offer them is not an opportunity for quality, because they will be competing with people from all over the world. As I have said to lots of groups in the last few weeks, I don't look much at U.S. news rankings. I look at the rankings from Shenzhou University in China. Why? Because that tells me who the up and coming competition is in terms of intellectual capital around the world. Because that's who really we have to be concerned with, everybody. So yes, we do have to find a way to broaden the college opportunity, but we also have to find a way to deepen it. And how are we going to do that? And the first thing is, and what I neglected to say earlier and should have, is that one of those working groups, the one on academic excellence and economic development, is focused directly on not just the commercialization of research, but also on finding those spires of excellence within each of our institutions. Those things that we already do well, that we could do better, that we can use then to organize an improvement for the future. So the board's already looking at that. Do I have a silver bullet about how to pay for all this? No, I don't. But I do know that we have to figure it out over the next few years. It's incumbent on all of us in this room to figure it out for the benefit of our own children. You know that, and I know that. And this board is committed to figuring that out. That's what its long-range planning group will have to do, and they know that. And they know that the tools at their disposal include those spires of excellence, they include those faculty, they include the students, they include the community colleges, but they have to include also a partnership with the state and with the private sector that will help make us make it affordable for us to achieve that.
Well, Madam Chair, my only comment, I'll channel Jim Johnson here, is I hope we don't do it the Oregon way, which is how we've traditionally parsed out. I hope we confront the really, really difficult choices that and actually have to pick some winners and pick some losers, because I think that's the only way you get to, and that, in my mind, that's how you get to excellence. And you build something that I think then you can come down here when the future mm-hmm. chancellor is here in 10 years can say to these panels, look, not, and the U.S. News is one gauge, but look at where we've come in 10 years in terms of our engineering programs or just the core rankings of our universities. Because to me, but it would entail doing something we have not been good at in Oregon, and that is being able having to say there are going to be folks who are going to be disappointed in the decisions, not just kind of a general spread out disappointment.
I think, Senator Decker, you're saying exactly what's going on to our neighbors to the north. Washington State has an excellent university system, huge investment by the legislature and the state, and the Oregonian, Bill Graves and Shelby Applewood, did a story on Sunday, February 13th, that illustrated that. And that's the sense that I get of what you're saying, is to focus that research, focus the universities that can really excel in these areas and stop spreading it out so that we're so thin and we don't focus that excellence. Is that kind of what you're this morning?
We have more campuses in Oregon than Washington does, with one-third less the one-third less the population. We have two-thirds of their population.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to move into the Oregon transfer model because we're going to get behind. Thank you, Chancellor. I appreciate
you
being
much.
Here. We'd like to hear from Karen Sprague, who's going to give us some information about the Oregon transfer module. Welcome, Karen.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting this presentation. If I can have a moment, I'll try to get the computer working here.
Yeah, I agree now. Maybe I'll bring, I think they, I'll try to get them to say they'll do it. That's what they say. They
And for the record, I'm Karen Sprague. I'm the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Studies at the University of Oregon.
Thank you.
I'm speaking this afternoon actually on behalf of a large number of people from four-year schools and two-year schools who have come together, both formally and informally, to try to solve some transfer problems. The impetus for this work came, I would say, from two sources. One, the Joint Boards Articulation Commission, which for a long time has been concerned with transfer issues and has created some transfer degrees to solve that problem, systematically collects reports of problems and tries to solve them. So that work was going along and was inspiring. In addition, we had the energy and leadership this year of the Board Work Group on Excellence and Delivery in Productivity. And the combination, I think, is what generated what I'm going to talk about. Oops. Sorry, this is not actually the one I wanted to show you. I'm sorry. We've had multiple PowerPoints for explaining this to several groups of people. Okay. So we all know that several thousand students transfer in Oregon each year, something between 5,000 and 6,000. Many of them transfer successfully, but there are problems, and there's no point in pretending that there aren't any. The transfer process is just really not as smooth as it should be. And specifically, the fact that we do have a rich array of curricular opportunities in the state, institutions have differentiated themselves to offer specialized programs and coursework. That's wonderful. That provides wonderful opportunities for students, but what the very richness of the array can be overwhelming, especially to beginning students, and that can lead to some inappropriate course choices right at the beginning. In addition, although we have the Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer Degree, which guarantees transferability of the general education coursework within it, students taking some of those same courses but not actually earning the degree are subject to different rules. So there's different transferability of the same coursework depending upon whether you've earned an AAOT degree or not. That's a problem. In addition, there's now so much information out there that it's really beyond the capability of a single person to grasp it all. And human limitations simply mean that inadequate information is sometimes transmitted. That causes errors in course selection. So how does the transfer degree, the Oregon Transfer Module help? So first of all, what is the Oregon Transfer Module? Here's another acronym, I'm afraid, OTM. It's something that can be completed in a single year. So in contrast to the Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer Degree, which is a two-year effort, this can be completed in a single year. And it includes foundational skills courses, written communication, oral communication, and mathematics. It also includes courses that are meant to introduce students, regardless of their major, to the disciplines, to arts and letters, social sciences, science, math, and computer science. So it focuses on general education. Students may take a couple of elective courses if the total number of credits doesn't add up to 45. So the module is designed to be completed in 1 year. 45 credits is the usual number that's earned in 1 year. And we've deliberately designed the module to be based on courses rather than credits, because we think that's a more sensible and understandable way to do business. And so the total number of credits can fluctuate slightly within those specified courses, and the difference will be made up through electives. Okay. Now, why does this help? It's guaranteed to be transferable among all public colleges and universities within Oregon. That is, just like the degree, the Associate of Arts degree, which takes 2 years to earn because it's all of general education plus a good many electives, this coursework will be transferable. As I said, it can be completed in 1 year. It can also be completed very readily with courses from multiple schools. So the idea is that all public colleges and universities within Oregon will adopt this and agree to allow students to earn the module with courses on any of those campuses. It can all be put together. The other nice thing about the module, in my opinion, is that it promotes rigor. The minimum grade that must be earned in a module course is C-. At present, I think a D- would suffice in the Oregon Transfer Degree. But to earn the module, the grade has to be a C-. So that's a step up, I think. Okay, so here's a summary of what I've been saying. We basically have in Oregon, or we would have if the module is adopted, two transferable general education packages. the one in the AAOT, the degree. And you can see the distribution of the different kinds of courses. The foundational skills courses are at the top in the bluish segments. Communication, that includes written communication as well as oral communication, and mathematics. The proportion of courses then devoted to introduction to the disciplines is shown by the larger segments, science, social science, arts and humanities. And these drawings are to scale, and so you can see that the module includes most of the general education that's already included in the transfer degree. Okay, so that seems great, but we still have work to do. The module does not take care of everything. We need to do some things to maximize its effectiveness. First of all, we need to use course equivalencies based on outcomes. And what I mean by that is instead of trying to come up with a system that requires all schools to offer the same courses, named the same way, numbered the same way, what we really want to do as educators, most of the time when we're introducing students, say, to a disciplinary area, is give them a sense, let's say, of what science is all about, to give them a sense of what the humanities are all about. And that can be done with a variety of courses that are not identical, but that achieve the same ends. And so what we need to do in the state is to come up with a statewide agreement on these kinds of criteria. That is, what is a humanities course? What's a good humanities course? What's it trying to do? And we've already started this work, actually, on an individual institutional level. Most schools in Oregon, four-year schools and two-year schools, have criteria of this sort that they already use in their internal curriculum committee to decide whether a proposed new course in the sciences, let's say, is appropriate. And some states have done this on a statewide scale, and Colorado is my personal favorite. You can go to the Colorado website and find their criteria for general education courses in all of the usual areas. And they're wonderful. But let me, as an example, just let me read you what Oregon State has right here in Oregon for general education courses in science. So now remember, these are courses whose goal is to introduce students who are not science majors to science, to ensure that all students emerge with a sense of how science works, what kinds of questions it tries to answer, and so forth. So here's what Oregon State says about the requirements for a course that would meet their science distribution requirement. Science seeks to develop a fundamental description and understanding of the natural world, from elementary particles to the cosmos, including the realm of living systems. Students should have opportunity to explore the insights of science, to view science as a human achievement, and to participate in scientific inquiry. This experience includes the challenge of drawing conclusions based on observation, analysis, and synthesis. To ensure a broad perspective, the science requirement consists of two parts, physical science and biological science. And more specifically, they say that science courses shall emphasize elements of critical thinking, focus on the meaning of the fundamental concepts and theories that broadly characterize basic physical and biological science, illustrate, demonstrate, and analyze natural phenomena and systems, provide historical perspectives and context on the evolution of major theories and ideas, and examine the nature, the value, and the limitations of scientific methods and the interaction of science with society. So that's the kind of thing that I think we need to do on a state level, get together and agree on criteria that we could all live with that would enable us to decide whether any particular course was appropriate in the science category, let's say, or not. The other thing that's crucial for the module to work is to provide first-rate advising. as I say, the module provides guidance. It provides some structure for beginning students, but it doesn't specify individual courses. And for that, students need to work with advisors, and advisors need access to good information. So, as I said here, the course equivalencies based on outcomes is already well underway. What we need to do is to identify the foundational skills courses, most of which have common numbers that don't yet have them, fill in those holes, and create statewide criteria for the introduction to disciplines courses.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a question, going back to my college days. There were those requirements, but at that point in time, we could satisfy those requirements, like by taking the first level courses in a discipline, and which is a track for that major, but it's general and broad. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that is still a possibility, and that's done in some cases. What's happened in some fields, and science is a good example, the sciences, all of them, I would say, are good examples, is that most non-science students, unfortunately, find the beginning science courses for majors inaccessible. So there are very few humanities majors that I can persuade to take general chemistry to satisfy their science requirement. And as a consequence, other courses that I think do a good job of presenting science and introducing students to scientific reasoning and the use of experimental results in reaching conclusions, those courses have been designed to be interesting and accessible to students who are not science majors.
Madam Chair, that almost sounds like dumbing down the system to me, in a way. If we want people to understand science and get a good basis in science, taking a class at the beginning of a major track, I would think would do a good job of that. And I can understand where chemistry might appear daunting to some folks, but when you get to college, it's supposed to be a challenge. I took chemistry in college and it was hard, but it's not supposed to be easy. So, I guess I'm wondering what used to work, I thought fairly well, why it doesn't work anymore. So, and unless we are turning out kids out of the K-12 system that aren't prepared to take hard disciplines, and that may be part of it. So. I don't know if there's a
question. Madam Chair, Cruz, I don't have a simple answer. I regret that more people are not interested or willing. I won't say that they're not able to take the beginning courses in the disciplines, but that seems to be the pattern. And if I can lean on a colleague, Mike Bishop, who is president of UCSF right now and won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for figuring out the genetic basis of cancer, is on a sort of nationwide crusade to convince scientists, to convince us, that we should in fact develop these kinds of special courses for people who are not scientists. His view is that the gap, however it happened, the gap has simply gotten too wide between scientists and non-scientists. And the communication problems are huge, and that we as scientists need to take the initiative and develop some accessible courses.
Okay, Madam Chair, I guess, I went to Willamette, and back then there was a foreign language requirement, which I absolutely hated, but I took it because I had to. It was a requirement, and if you want to graduate, you got to meet the requirements. So, and I also took intro to, I took biology, and I think I took physics, which were hard, but I got the concepts, and I got, I know how science works because I took the classes, and maybe I'm too old for this stuff.
All I know is we have about 5 more minutes to wrap this up, because then I need to open a public hearing on 2 other bills we have today, and we wanted to get a little presentation from Val Ward and Cindy Bacar,
right,
on how this works. So maybe we could just stop right there and cut our losses with Senator Cruz and have that little presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I think I would like to introduce 2 colleagues, Valerie Ward, who's the Dean of Business and Social Science from Mount Hood Community College, and Cindy Bacar, who is the Associate Director of Admissions, Registration, and Records at Portland State University, who are going to show you how you can get first-rate advisory.
So we don't end up as fifth-year seniors because we haven't figured out how to get what we need, right?
Exactly. Madam Chair, esteemed senators, as members of this committee, as introduced, my name is Valerie Ward Martinez. I'm the Dean of Business and Social Science at Mount Hood Community College. Thank you for having us here today. It's our pleasure, and we welcome this opportunity to share the vision with you, to demonstrate the power of adopting a degree audit system in Oregon. We hope to gain your support for this proposal to increase excellence in productivity and delivery for Oregon students. To provide a short background, we understand we have 5 minutes. Mine will be very short, but I believe as foundational information, it may be important for you to know that in May of 2004, at the regular meeting of university deans and business department chairs from community colleges and universities in the state, we were challenged by Jerry Richmond, who spoke to our group as representative of the higher ed board, to consider innovative ways in which excellence in delivery and productivity could be enhanced for all students in education in Oregon. After a brief hallway informal chat, several members of this group, representing community colleges and universities, proposed a plan to implement an automated and linked degree audit system for the state of Oregon. This proposal, in concept, was forwarded to the members of the university deans and business department chairs for consideration at their fall meeting in 2004. The membership wholeheartedly, enthusiastically endorsed the proposal, and an advocacy group was formed to see how far we could go with implementing the plan as part of the proposal. Representing Portland State University, Mount Hood Community College, University of Oregon, our group has proposed the Articulation Transfer Linked Degree Audit System Oregon, acronym fondly referred to as ATLAS, to the Community College President's Council, the Oregon Higher Ed Registrars Group, the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, the Joint Boards of Articulation Commission, who have written a position paper, the Governor's Educational Policy Advisor, the Community College Services Office, the Board of Higher Ed Subcommittee for Excellence in Delivery and Productivity, chaired by Gretchen Schutte. We have since that time become a subcommittee of the subcommittee, and each of those presentations at each of those levels, again, was met with passionate and enthusiastic support and endorsement. At this time, I would like to turn this portion of the presentation over to my colleague after first pointing you to the packet that we provided. It has a Portland State University logo on the front. If you'll open the packet on the left side, is a brief synopsis of our proposal, indicating and describing what a degree audit reporting system is, and they're expanding that idea to what a linked degree audit system is for the whole state of Oregon. And as Cindy goes through her portion of the demonstration, we believe it would be very helpful and valuable for you to have this multi-page handout that's on the right-hand side of the presentation. It's marked very clearly. And our experiences in the PowerPoint presentations were that sometimes it was too complicated or hard to read, so we provided both mechanisms. Cindy will be your guide through the demonstration of it, the existing degree audit reporting and course applicability system at Portland State University. And I will turn it over to her.
Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for your time. And I'm Cindy Bacar, the Associate Director at Portland State University, and I'm going to talk briefly about the CAS system that we implemented there. And CAS stands for Course Applicability System, and it's a software package that we purchased and implemented so that students who aren't yet admitted to PSU and haven't come to us yet have the same exact access to information that our admitted students have. Just to give you a little brief background, about 5 years ago, we implemented an automated degree audit system at Portland State University. And that had two main parts that are important for you to know about. One is we developed an elaborate series of transfer tables, if you can imagine them, for each of the community colleges and four-year schools in Oregon, which basically we went through those tables and built course-by-course equivalencies for all the courses other schools offer and how those courses transfer to PSU. That's what I'm going to refer to as transfer tables. The degree audit system also has, it's an automated version of all of our degree audits. So for internal students, they can run degree audit progress reports at any point from admission on through graduation, and we use these reports in advising, and we use them for degree certification. So we did that about 5 years ago. About 3 years after we implemented this system for our native students, we purchased the CAS system as an add-on piece, and it's a web interface that comes in and sits on top of those existing degree audit systems. And it basically allows folks who are not students at PSU yet, maybe they're just potential students looking to see where they might want to transfer, it allows them to go in one simple place and have access to all of this really good information that we have for our native students. And I might mention that all of the other four-year institutions have similar systems to what we have in terms of internal degree audits and transfer articulations. They don't, may not have the same system we have, but they're all working on developing these underlying systems. So I'm going to show you very briefly what a student can do by logging into CAS. And the first thing in your packet and what's displaying on the screen demonstrates how a student can access the transfer table information. This shows how if a student wanted to go in and look up the courses at Chemeketa Community College and see how they transfer to PSU, at this example shows psychology courses, and on the right-hand column you see the Chemeketa psychology courses. On the right-hand, sorry, on the right you see the Portland State equivalencies. And what you can see is, for example, Psych 100 transfers to PSU as a Psych LD or lower division elective. You see a couple of courses there, Psych 201 and 202, which transfer to PSU with very specific course number equivalencies. And that makes sense to me because I know that at PSU, in the psychology department, 99% of the course offerings are at the 300 level. So it makes sense that we don't have any 200 level equivalencies. But where we do find matches, we give them PSU numbers. And that's just one way to access the transfer tables. If you look on the next page, I'll show you an example, and I'll try to go there now online to show you how you can search these tables by another method. You can search by course such that you go into the system, search by course, and I want to search for Psychology 321. In Oregon. And I'm doing a search now, and it should come back to me momentarily. So what this tells me is that within the state of Oregon, there are two universities that offer direct equivalencies to Portland State's Psychology 321. And this is very powerful for a student. You can imagine I'm a Portland Community College student. It's spring term. I know that I'm going to transfer to PSU in the fall. I'm at home on a spring Friday night doing what students naturally do, plan for transfer. And my mother wants me to get started in the summer on my PSU courses for fall, but I don't want to hang around Portland for the summer. I've got other plans. So I can use CAS at home, go in, do a search like this, and find out what some alternatives are for me at other schools that offer courses. So at Oregon State, they offer the course at a different number, but it will transfer to PSU precisely the way I need it to for my research methods course. On the next page, we have another example of a search that I did for Math 251. And as you can imagine, there are lots of schools across Oregon that offer direct equivalencies to Math 251 because that's a very common course. Did it come back? Let's see. Well, let's look on your handout. I did a screenshot of some examples there. Okay. If you scroll down, or if you look at your example, you'll see Mount Hood Community College, Oregon State, Pacific University. And what this basically shows us that many schools have equivalents to Math 251. Many of them have direct course numbers. They use the same course number we do. Some schools use different numbers. Look at Pacific University. They use different numbers, but we take the course with no problem. And some schools have changed course numbers over time. You can look at the Oregon State University, but they are by no means alone in this, in the way this works. And you can see how they've changed the number over time. But the CAS system allows us to track these differences very easily and helps us keep up with them as well as the students, and most importantly, the advisors at the community colleges and so forth, because they will see students that bring in old transcripts that have these old numbers on there, and they can use the system to know what we're going to do with that at PSU. I'm not going to go into showing you online because it'll take too much time, but I'm going to briefly tell you that what I've just given you an example of is some simple ways that students can access these transfer tables. And that's a lot of information, and that's good, but CAS does something that's even more powerful. It will allow the student to go in and create an account, type in all of the courses that the student has taken at multiple institutions, and basically create a little transcript in the CAS system, and then run that transcript against all of the degree plans that PSU has displayed in CAS, which would be all of our majors. And so on page 4, you will see just a screenshot of a part of a degree audit. And this example is the Bachelor of Science degree audit requirement. And you can see in the upper left-hand corner that the status says no, so that means not all of the requirements are met. There are four parts. Number one has a little plus sign, which indicates that that requirement has been met. And the course that was used was Chemeketa Math 243. Transferred in as Statistics 243 at PSU and met the requirement. If you go down and look at number 4, it's also met, 12 credits from Arts and Letters or Social Science. The courses that were used were listed. They're all transfer courses. Some of them came in with direct number matches, but Econ 115 for Mount Hood came in as Econ LD, lower division. That just means we don't teach that exact course, but it's a fine course. It comes in and it applies to this part of the student's degree, and the student knows that before he or she ever steps foot on Portland State campus, before he or she has ever been admitted to PSU, and can use this information in planning as to whether or not he or she needs to take another social science course. So,
Ms. Bacar, could I ask you, this is a really cool program. Those were the days of standing in Mac Court for hours to register, and you hoped you drew an early number so you could get in before the third day and not get any classes. But, you know, assuming you have a student who doesn't keep track of their transcript, mm-hmm. is there any way for them to access the system to say, search for my transcripts at all these universities, and it pulls it up so they can track that?
Madam Chair and Senators, the answer to that is, at this point, CAS, we PSU is the only school that has CAS, and we use it, and we haven't developed that capability. A lot of states have bought into CAS on a statewide basis so that all the different schools could put this type of information in there. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, a student in the center of this website would be able to get all these schools' information, not just PSU. And some states, as I understand it, have developed relationships where they actually make it a bit more sophisticated, so that if you were a PCC student, you would log in, and it has to do with authenticating the student to make mm-hmm. sure the student is logging into a secured site. And if you set up those relationships, it's conceivable that the student could log in, a PCC student could log into CAS, through that log into PCC and say, dump my courses into CAS so I don't have to type them in.
Right.
That would be a more sophisticated level that we haven't taken it to yet, but okay. You could see that if we got this at a state level, we could move it on in those
absolutely.
Ways.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you. I hate to rush you, but we should probably move on with the rest of our agenda. Was there any other point you wanted to make before you...
No, I think on page 5 you can see just another example from the degree audit, a selected mm-hmm. course, and it show you can see that where it's circled there, it says course list STAT 244 is a course that's still needed, and in parentheses in green it says ST 202, and because I ran that audit against an OSU reference articulation, it tells me what course I could take at Oregon State University, for example. So the students can play around with the system mm-hmm. and do what if. What if I took this course, and what if I went to that school? How would it work for my PSU degree?
something that we'll all be doing on a Friday spring night, right?
Right.
Becky. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senators, we have provided the one-page handout with contact information. If you have questions or comments, need additional information, please feel free to do that.
Okay, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right, colleagues, it is 20 minutes to 5. I don't know how good we will be at getting done right at 5. Senator Courtney's coming in the room. We're going to be hearing two bills next, and if we can get Senator Decker back in here at some point, too, I'd like to open a work session and move a bill.
He's here.
Oh, do we want to do that now? Yeah. I would like to, Senator Courtney, if you don't mind, we're just going to have a work session on a bill real quick. Colleagues, I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 414. This bill, Madam Administrator, would you please tell us why it needs to go where it needs to go?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we heard testimony on Senate Bill 414 on the 14th, and this is the half-day or full-day kindergarten bill. It has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, and I believe at the last meeting when we heard it, you suggested that that's the place that you would send it today.
Yes, thank you, Marjorie. This bill is had a referral to go to revenue. I thought we were all pretty interested in the testimony that we heard last week, and I know there's issues about wanting to fund Head Start first and all of those things, but Senator Deckard has expressed an interest in getting that bill, this extended day kindergarten bill, in his committee to work it with some of the other issues that he has before his committee. And so that's why I wanted to move that bill today. And I think, Senator Cruz, you wanted to respond to that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and it's not that I'm necessarily opposed to the concept, but I just didn't want this necessarily to go to revenue clean. I'll be voting no, quite simply because I think in our short revenue situation, if dollars were found, I would prefer to see the cuts to Head Start restored rather than moving in this direction. So for that purpose, I will vote no.
Thank you. Any other comments? Senator Starr, you look like you want to say something.
I'm ready to move the bill to revenue, but I have a concern along the same lines as Senator Cruz. I believe that with the short revenues that we have, we're going to have a hard time diluting our funding to fund full-day kindergarten in this session, but it's worthy of discussion in revenue as we look at our school formula. And so I will support moving it to revenue. I might not support it out of revenue.
Oh, yes, you do serve on that committee as well. That's handy. Senator Morsett, did you have any comments?
Well, I am totally supportive of a half-day kindergarten. Beyond that, I'm not, but I will move the bill to revenue.
All right. Senator Deckard, any comments? Okay. Well, I also, colleagues, want to let you know that I am researching with the Department of Ed and finding out who their person is that is supposed to be advising these schools that are Title I schools about how to access that money, that free federal money for extended day kindergarten. So I'll keep you posted on what I learn about that. So let's move the bill. Ms. Tussaud, I think we need a motion by
Madam Chair. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 414 to revenue. With a recommendation? Without recommendation. We will see.
Without recommendation? All right, Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 414 to revenue without recommendation. I don't think there's any more discussion, so Ms. Tussaud, you want to call the roll?
Senator Decker?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Morsett?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Senate Bill 414, having received the required constitutional number of votes, will be moved to the Senate President's desk for its assignment to revenue. And I will close the work session, and then we will open a public hearing on our next two bills. I'm going to open a hearing on both Senate Bill 369 and Senate Bill 342, and I believe we have both Senator Schrader and Senator Courtney here. Oh, double treat. Could both of you come forward? I know that you probably didn't talk to each other about these bills before you dropped them, so what a surprise to find out you were both thinking along the same lines. Thank you. And while you're being seated, I'll have Ms. Taylor summarize the two bills for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the Senate Bill 342 and Senate Bill 369. Both of them direct the State Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education to develop a common course numbering system, and these bills direct state institutions to accept for credit towards a degree any credits that are granted by the other state institutions. I'd like to identify the difference between the two bills, and that is that Senate Bill 342, that's Senator Schrader's bill, requires that institutions accept credits that were received at community colleges, universities, and credits that were taken in high school at community colleges or universities. However, Senate Bill 369 requires that the institutions accept credits received from community colleges and universities. However, it remains silent on the high school issue.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Well, let's see. Who should go first? We could do this by seniority by age, seniority by service in the legiture,
Bill number.
All right, we'll do it by bill number. Senate Bill 342 comes before 369, so we'll roll with that one first.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and the deference shown to me by the great President of Augusta, Oregon State Senate. Madam Chair, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to testify here in support of Senate Bill 342. Senate Bill 342 is an outgrowth of work that I and many members of this assembly did during the interim on an interim higher education work group that had revenue, ways and means, and other members on it to try and ascertain what we're trying to accomplish and hopefully how we could come together on things for higher education this legislative session. One of the outstanding aspects of the work in the interim was the work proposed by the governor, taken up by the State Board of Higher Education, affectionately known as More Better Faster. This bill is an outgrowth, a very obvious outgrowth of the endeavor we have here to try and get young men and women through our Oregon higher education system in a faster, better, more timely, and cost-effective manner. I've listened upstairs to the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation you got from the Joint Board's Articulation Commission's work on the transfer module. That's a really great piece of work, and I appreciate, quite frankly, the difficulty in coming to agreement on that sort of thing. We have a lot of different educational institutions in the state, each very proud of their tradition and heritage and how they approach the courses. So I think it's no small achievement that these people have come together, these professors, these universities, and trying to make things better for our students. I support that concept of transparency. I support also the online access that's being talked about as far as making it easier for students to access the system and chart their progress through our educational institutions. However, I think it's also rather complicated. I was going to give you all a test after listening upstairs to make sure you could understand exactly how you would get through this system if you were a high school senior, a freshman in college, or a community college student. And I think, albeit a well-deserved system, it's a little bit complicated. My bill is, the wording in the bill, the numbering system, is not that important to me. What is important to me is that as young men and women enter college, they have some assurance that the credits they took, their advanced placement credits in high school or at a community college or, frankly, at a different Oregon university system, public university, would transfer automatically amongst themselves. I'm worried about the student going to college. I'm not so worried about developing your major. The guts and the intention behind my bill is basically simple and twofold. Number one, that all 100-level courses in our university system, community college system, would be automatically transferable from one to another. If Kurt Schrader decides to go to community college, at Clackamas Community College, I don't have to worry that I've got a sweetheart system set up with PSU that's been very thoughtful and I think very innovative in its willingness to accept transfer credits. But I can go to Western. I go to Eastern. I go to the University of Oregon with my 100-level math, English, history, core courses. That should be an automatic. A student in this state should know, as a result of the work that this legislative assembly does this biennium, that their coursework will automatically transfer, no questions asked in any single course. Secondly, I think it's really important to address the high school issue. When a student takes an advanced placement course, that course should be structured and worked out enough with the community college and Oregon University system that that advanced placement course in and of itself would also automatically allow that student to not have to take the equivalent 100-level course at community college or Oregon University. They don't have to repeat the work they did in advanced placement in high school. There should also be a provision that, of course, if they took an advanced placement test, they may also be able not only to place out of the 100-level course, but maybe a higher-level course, depending on how they did on that test. And that also needs to be established. So that's where I'd like to see my modest little Senate Bill 342 go. Address the entry-level student, the 100-level courses, and the ability to transfer, without question, AP courses. Not on you get 3 out of 4 credits, but 100%. That course will satisfy the Math 101 requirement. That'll satisfy the English 101 requirement. Make it very simple, very transparent to Oregon students. With that, I'm open to friendly amendments. I've been talking to the university system people, the community college people, have some pretty neat ideas. Open to working collaboratively with the great, illustrious, Gus President of the Oregon State Senate. His long years of wisdom and experience in the university system that I know will be very, very helpful to all of us. So with that, I think the funding crisis in our state right now begs us addressing this issue right here, right now. It's time to show these kids that we really care about getting them through our system in a thoughtful and expeditious manner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. I hope you are successful at your conversations, because everyone who's testified, signed up to testify today, is all opposed to the bill. So yours also, Mr. President.
You carry a lot of weight in this building, ma'am.
And there will be budgetary consequences.
All right, Mr. President, introduce yourself, please. Would people like to change their...
Chair Walker and members of the Senate Education and Workforce Committee, Vice Chair Starr and Senator Marcet, Senator Cruz, Senator Duckett, and High Learned Administrator Audrey Taylor. I'm Peter Courtney, and I reside at 2925 Island View Drive, North Salem, 97303, and I'm a state senator from District 11. I'm here today to testify about, watch this, Senate Bill 369. I want to correct my testimony. I believe you should have my testimony in front of you. If I carefully did what you've ordered me to do, is to have a copy, and well, I don't want you to read from it, because I'm not going to. I have to make a correction. The second sentence is wrong. There are not 19 community colleges. There are 17 community colleges.
We thought you maybe had
no, I think,
handed that.
Community colleges play a vital role in our state. They are vital resources for adult vocational continuing education throughout Oregon. In addition, they are increasingly the first option, at least the school that I'm involved in, they are the first option for students out of high school who are, for one reason, not choose not to, or simply cannot afford to enroll at full-time as a full-time student as a public university. And I cannot emphasize that opening remark fast enough. At least from my background, where I'm coming from, I have watched this happen over a period of years. It's particularly becoming more and more prevalent that the community college, particularly around my area, whether it's Chemeketa, Lynn Denton, Lane, the Mount Hood, I go on and on and on, have become now more and more students are going there, although we've got a problem with that too, as you know, in the budgets in terms of their tuition. They'll start there with the idea, I got a shot at a bachelor's degree, first generation, I'll start here, I'm going to transfer. Hold that thought. We are painfully aware that Oregon's budgetary problems have taken a toll on higher education, and it truly has. I heard a very dramatic statement made by somebody recently that about Oregon being the only state in the union now. If this is true, it's killing me, that does not have a long-term version for higher education. I just heard that from, maybe it was the governor, or just moments ago, and that just tells you what's going on. And there's 5 special sessions, and recently as the 2003 sessions, that we have pounded on higher ed, and we also have that very much in our thoughts, as well as the community college system. Due to funding constraints, our public universities have raised tuition repeatedly in recent years, with the consequences that more and more Oregon students are beginning their post-secondary education at community colleges with an eye toward eventual transferring. Now, this tuition thing is a monster. I have often advocated freezing tuition. I've got myself in trouble advocating it for reasons that you perhaps can figure out why, given my employment. No longer can I do that as often as I'd like to, because it would not be the responsible thing to do. I feel like I'm caught between an earthquake and a volcano, because on the other hand, I want to freeze tuition. On the other hand, I know what the demands are on a higher education system. So playing into all this is the community college. Unfortunately, transferring can be anything but seamless. Students may arrive at a university after 1 or 2 years at a community college only to find that some of their credits they earn are not accepted by that university towards its requirements. Community college students who are trying to tailor their course selections to ensure an efficient transition to a university can be confused by the institution's varying course numbers, descriptions, and degree requirements. This means they depend on good faculty advising, which they may not always get. Now, I'm just, Senate Bill 369 is intended to resolve this problem by requiring the state boards of education and boards of higher education to jointly develop a common course numbering system and requiring the state's universities and community colleges to accept all of each other's credits towards degree requirements. Now, I just want to make a statement here that will make the good chair happy, as well as some of the members in the audience. I want you to understand something. I have been on the front lines of this in terms of academic advising, one of my positions at a certain university. And I can tell you the confusion sometimes, even among those who do a lot of advising, and I'm not very good at it, is unbelievable when you get transcripts and things coming into your admissions office. And admissions counselors will look at those transcripts. They're trying to do the best they can. It gets to be a very difficult situation. And all we're trying to do here is try to help as much as possible the universities, as well as the students, as well as, you know, our citizens, to work their way through this maze so they can get that degree. Here's a confession, though, and this you'll love. Just a day or two after Senate Bill 369 was filed, the Joint Boards of Education announced the creation of the Oregon Transfer Module. I was not aware that the OTM was being developed. Since then, I have been visited by the president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. He came to see me, who was very enthusiastic about the collaborative process that led to the development of the OTM. The reason I got to tell you this, he happens to be an individual who works at my university, and he proceeded to tell me what he thought of my bill in no uncertain terms, as well as what he thought of me. He's a professor of biology. He's in the audience today. And so he went into some detail with me, as well as Chris Garrett, all of which I did not understand. And I say that for this reason. Chris understood it. Chris is a very bright person. But what I'm telling you is, maybe we don't have to worry if I don't understand it, but it still doesn't quite make sense to me. But having said that, my priority is very simple, to make it easier for students to plot their academic careers and to give them the certainty that when they take courses at community colleges and with the expectation that they can make their credits, they can take their credits with them, they are not wasting their time or money. It is not clear to me that the OTM accomplishes everything that we need to do in order to reach this goal. But it is clear that the OTM is a major step in the right direction. I'm also encouraged about the institutions, all of them, ability to work together on an ongoing basis to deal with the hurdles that may remain. It is critical that we have this discussion, and I'm glad that the committee has provided a forum today for us to learn more about the OTM and about how we can take better care of our community college students. Thank you. Now, I just want to make a statement there. This is a remarkable thing, this thing they have developed, because they've had to get together to do it, and that is gigantic. So I told the good chair of this committee, I'm not saying that my bill is the greatest bill in the world or it necessarily should be the vehicle or necessarily, I don't even know now how much it's necessary or not. But what I do know is there is an issue, and this committee, through its taking the leadership of this public hearing, could very well be the committee that cinches and guarantees for the future that this issue of community college students transferring to one of our major universities is taken care of. So I thank you very much, Chair Walker, sincerely so, for at least scheduling these bills and allowing us to come here to talk about them so that we can get this kind of discussion underway.
Thank you, gentlemen. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, President Courtney, two questions. Number one, would you have opposition to what Senator Schrader had as far as advanced placement high school classes also being included if they're structured right? And the other question was, what was the major objection to your bill? Because it looks like a fairly straightforward concept to me.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, no, I wouldn't have any objection at all. In fact, I'm upset that I didn't think of it before he did. all my sons have taken AP, and one of them is still taking AP as a junior in high school. And what I didn't know is that all of them, when they applied to different schools, most of the schools, now we don't have to worry about this because some of the schools are out of state, but some of them are in this state, they're private. They don't accept necessarily AP, a lot of the schools. You've got to know that. I think the students think they are going to be accepted, but all of a sudden they send their transcripts in, and this school plays God and says, we'll only accept these few. Others will say, we'll accept the whole thing. So there is that issue, and that's a very good point that he's bringing up in terms of keeping faith with our students who are going to our high schools in the state of Oregon about AP, at least in terms of our public university system, because I'm not sure, Chair Walker, you can speak to the private universities in the state with this legislation. I could be wrong. I don't know if you could speak to Willamette across the street or to Reed, for example, Pacific. I'm just going to be very upfront with you, and I don't know whether the good senator wants to speak to that or not. I don't mean to complicate. You know, I don't know the answer to your second question, because I don't understand this model. This model, I'm going to tell you something. The thing you got to remember, it takes years to become certified smart and taking these transcripts and reading them and then relating them to your curriculum in a way that's understandable and making decisions. I'm not kidding you on that. I'm not kidding you. I don't dare advise any more than first or second term freshmen at Western Oregon University in terms of Western's core curriculum. I wouldn't touch a transcript that came in from any one of our community colleges in terms of trying to advise a student ahead of time or if it came in and telling them whether or not they fit Western Oregon University's curriculum. I wouldn't touch it. I wouldn't touch it. I teach, for example, Speech 111. Speech 111, the fundamentals of public speaking, is the fundamental course on public speaking. 100-level class. You know, it'd be very interesting to look at the community colleges and see what they do in the area of speech, because there's a variety of classes. And to be frank with you, I think they can confuse me on occasion in terms of I'd be reading a transcript and saying, I don't know whether this fits Speech 111 at Western Oregon University or not. By the way, Speech 111 at Western Oregon University is absolutely required. You cannot graduate from Western Oregon University without that class. So I understand U of O, Senator Walker, Senator Deckard, for example, you're not required to take speech. You are at Western Oregon, and that's the class you've got to take. That is, you've got to take the basic class. So if you were at Lane, or you were at Lynn, or at Chemeketa, I'm not sure the number systems match up. Maybe I could do it by the words they've written. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So you need the certified smart people behind me. You've got a chancellor here. You have the president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Center here to tell you why my bill is not necessary and how this new form takes care of everything that we're talking about here. Because I'm uncertain right now as I talk to you today if it does or it doesn't. I'm being upfront with you.
Madam Chair. Do you have a curriculum guide from your school or...
Absolutely. Senator Walker, Senator Marzette, absolutely.
Okay, so Speech 101 will not change when you leave?
It's not Speech 101, but I'm glad you said Speech 101. It's Speech 111. Why they call it Speech 111 versus Speech 101, I don't know. Well, I don't mean to be a smart aleck here. I'm just telling you. Will it change?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's changing all the time. I teach my class a certain way. You tell me.
Okay. Follow up, please.
You don't want to get into that, Senator.
Okay, what you're getting at, then, is that the system of the schools throughout the system would have an identical curriculum guide. Do they have that now? Okay, community colleges do not have an identical curriculum guide, and that could be a problem.
Senator Walker, Senator Morris said, I don't know the answer to your question. What I do know is I used a very simplistic approach in my bill. Probably too simplistic. I said all courses would be numbered the same. Higher ed resents that very much. They don't like that. Every faculty at every university, I'll be up front with you, they do not want to be totally told what they teach in a given course or not. Now I am going to say something will get me in trouble, but it's absolutely true. It's true for every one of the universities, not just for one of them. That's public and private. It's very much of a world that is very, that's the way you feel when you're in that world. And there's reasons for that. There's reasons for that in terms of what they want to teach their students, how they want to prepare them for certain degrees. I mean, you know, these are highly intelligent people, highly motivated people, but which is fine. But you just take the area of core curriculum. Let's just take core curriculum. Does everybody understand core curriculum? I don't mean to insult anybody here. It's different than you get a degree, a BS or a BA. Mine happens to be in political science. It could have been in history, English, or speech. But regardless, at Western Oregon, you have to take a certain number of credits and a certain number of courses, certain areas, regardless of what your degree is in the day you graduate. Even in the core curriculum area, I think there's some confusion in terms of the classes coming over. Even though many students their first 2 years start to take classes, as you know, Senator Walker, in an area they want to major in. But I'm going back to the basic core curriculum area. i.e. at Western, you want to go to Western, you're going to take speech. Now, you don't have, you can take speech your junior, senior year, as opposed to, you know, you don't have to take it your first year or second year at a community college. But it'd be nice if a student says, you know, I hate this. I run into many students in my class, they're terrified the first day, and they're just terrified, they're shaking. But they say, I want to get this out of the way. So most of my students are freshmen or sophomores. My last term I taught it, I had for the first time a junior and a senior, one of whom was a community college student. And what I'm saying is, some of the people who took my class were transfers, but they never took it there. But they said they were not sure whether they should have or not. I'm just playing on one class. I could play on a number. But this model may very well have taken care of all the problems that you're asking about. So it's clear to the student as well as to the institutions what's going to happen when you transfer from Lane Community College to Oregon State, or U of O, or Western Oregon.
Thank you. I think what you're getting at is something that I've, as a high school teacher, have known all along, is that a course changes depending on who teaches it, and to have a common curriculum guide means nothing, really, in terms of what a student may end up having to cover. And I can see some real problems in, you know, saying all 101 classes are the same, because they're not going to be the same. They're going to be very different depending on the institution and the individuals. So I don't know how you solve that problem.
Madam Chair,
yes,
members of the committee, Senator Moore said, I respect that opinion, because I would hope that not every class ever would be the same. We wouldn't need the teachers. but I think what I would get at is that hopefully there'd be at least a minimum standard that we could all adhere to, and then I would certainly hope that each individual professor would use his or her ability to inspire the students with additional knowledge that they could take forward into their university experience.
Sounds good.
Did you have a question, Senator Kirk?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Senator Schrader, on that point, and I understand why you have a bill. I do not understand why the Senate President has a bill. Just having participated a little bit in the work group, my understanding was that they were going to go out, develop this model in an aggressive fashion, and bring it back to us. And I don't know if you've looked at the model that they have for implementation. I think it's, I want to say, October, November of the next year. But my feeling is if it meets the objectives that we set out in that work group, then it should be, the process should have worked the way we would have hoped it would, which is they really huddled, they worked hard at finding something that worked for the community colleges and the higher education system. And I think that's the testimony that we're going to get probably in the next 15, 20 minutes, is the nature of opposition would be around that issue that we've worked it out. And I don't know if it's met the objectives that you hope for. And
I don't know either yet. I hope to listen to the conversation. Thank you very much.
Chair Walker,
yes.
Chair Deck, I just hope everybody understands the student comes first, in the sense of that struggling person today who's at Lane and Chemeketa and Lynn. That's all I'm going to say. That's pretty important. I totally understand what you're saying, and maybe my bill is not necessary, but I'm just saying that, and I do think they've made a heck of an effort here, and I wasn't part of your work group, but I do think that it is a struggle. I've witnessed it firsthand, and all I'm trying to do is, I know higher ed wants to do it, I know the community colleges want to do it, but I often find it interesting somehow or other they struggle to get there, and maybe this is the model that does.
Senator Starr has a question.
My concern and question goes to the issue of all of those courses we saw listed that didn't align with the university system across the board. I would think that if we are encouraging students to take AP courses or community college courses, that those courses should be of such character as to be quality, to be transferable, that they shouldn't be investing their time and wasting their money buying a course that doesn't propel them toward early graduation with a degree from our four-year universities. And Senator Courtney, you're exactly correct that it is the students that we're concerned about and their education, and not wasting time on courses that don't compute toward a degree. It just seems like a waste of student effort and faculty effort that we have so designed those courses that they don't qualify for the credits that are transferable. So I commend what you've done here with these bills, and I would hope that we are all working toward the same goal, and that is to get our students through the system well educated with the highest expectations for their future.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you both.
Appreciate you coming. Colleagues, it's 10 after 5, but we have 8 people signed up. I'm going to give them 3 minutes apiece, which takes us to 24 minutes from now. And then if there's a question or two, I don't want to go past 5:40 because I'm tired, and I imagine you are as well. So let me bring up the first three, Joanne Truesdell, Elaine Yandel-Roth, and Agnes Hoffman. And ladies, be mindful, no more than 3 minutes apiece, please.
Thank you, Senator Walker and committee members. For the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And with me, I have Elaine Yandel-Roth, Community College and Workforce Development Education Specialist, who's been with us over the years developing many of the course numbering, course content guides, OTM, Oregon Transfer Module Activities, knowledgeable about the area. And also Agnes Hoffman, Vice Provost, Portland State University in Enrollment Services and Management. Just as an opener and clarifying position on whether or not agreement, disagreement against four, it is more complicated than that. The bill, as crafted from the perspective of community college and workforce development, identifies one particular area that, as Elaine will explain, we worked on about 15 years ago. What we're asking and what we're thinking about is a stronger commitment to work with a work group regarding several of these issues that combine transferring as a transfer student, as a community college student, transferring, which is my background. We also had, even in early 1980s, issues, concerns, and so forth. Those were addressed in legislation. We've moved forward using technology, using individual kinds of services to work with students. And so I just ask for a broader look at the issue of transfer instead of simply identifying course numbering as the only opportunity.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Elaine Yandel-Roth, and I work with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I've been working on student transfer issues for the past 20 years. The efforts of the colleges and universities has gone on long before I took responsibility for those areas. We had a group called the State System Community College Coordinating Committee that worked for many years. And then in 1987, the community colleges asked that something be done because we didn't feel enough of our courses were transferring. It wasn't good enough, and we're always working and getting better. At that time, in 1987, House Bill 2913 was passed. The result from that was what we call the Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer Degree. It also called for, to the extent possible, common course numbering within the state, and established the Joint Boards Articulation Commission as the oversight group for that. Since that time, the OUS system and the community college office has had responsibility for maintaining, administering, and continuing to try to find ways to ease transfer with the students. In doing that, we have come up with the Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer Degree, which we have maintained and updated frequently over the years. We published in 1992 the list of common course numbers that were to be used in the state. There are over 500 courses in that catalog, and we learned a lot of lessons along the road that we hope to move forward from rather than repeating. There were no dollars connected with either the development or the maintenance, and that got in the way of communication. We have better communication methods now with email and video conferencing and so forth, but we see that as a potential difficulty, particularly in the maintenance of effort. in where we choose to spend those efforts. We also have developed an Associate of Science Oregon Transfer degree in business, because that was one of our problem areas. For the AAOT degree, Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree, guarantees that all lower division general education requirements have been met. It does not apply for, it does not say that you have entry into a major or that your major requirements have been met, but the lower division general ed had been met. The Associate of Science Oregon Transfer in Business takes that guarantee, and it takes it one step further, including the common business courses, so that students are ready to enter, not necessarily they are not automatically entered into a business degree, but they will have taken the courses necessary. The Oregon Transfer Module, you have heard about earlier today. One of the big pieces of that was the reaffirmation that a course that was taken in social science at one university would be applied as social science in the other, unless it was to the student's interest to do it in a different manner. Anthropology might be a good example of that, where, and a lot of our institutions are also doing interdisciplinary courses. And so if they took one of those courses at the University of Oregon and then transferred to Chemeketa or Oregon State, a course that was very similar might be taught in science. And so the guarantee that it would apply as it was taken, and a reaffirmation of that, has been important. As you've noticed, and I have some examples in that handout, we have course equivalency tables. You saw those earlier today. We have hundreds of articulation agreements between our institutions, both for majors and with the general education. We have developed either co-enrollment models or dual enrollment models between our institutions. Probably the dual enrollment model that is most often cited is Lynn Benton and OSU, where they have a variety of agreements, but students are enrolled in both institutions at the same time. And for the last 8 years, we have held a one-day conference on transfer and articulation focused toward advisors and others that at our colleges that work on transfer and articulation issues. With that, I'd like to turn the mic over to Agnes Hoffman. Agnes happens to be one of the members of the Joint Boards Articulation Commission.
Chairman Walker, members of the esteemed Senate Committee, my name is Agnes Hoffman. I'm the Associate Vice Provost. I thank you for the promotion. Associate Vice Provost at Portland State University. And my job is to supervise some of the areas that you saw today, including the development of the course applicability system and the degree audit system that we have at Portland State. We are very, very concerned about the legislation here, because we share your worries and your concern that Senator Schrader and Senator Courtney presented in their bills. As a member of JBAC, the Joint Boards Articulation Commission, I can say that that group has been worried and had its hands around this issue for quite a while. And we support the Oregon Transfer Module, as we do support the Oregon Atlas System. The purpose of my remarks today would be to represent the Joint Boards, which includes members from the Oregon University System, the community college systems, and the four-year university and colleges, both private and public. So we have a paper that I've handed out to you today that is our position. It is quite remarkable that this group unanimously supports these two initiatives, the OTM, the Oregon Transfer Module, for many of the reasons that were presented earlier that I won't repeat, but I would like to point out some things in that position paper, and then I will be quiet. The joint boards proposes that the model that is being suggested in these two bills is, while the outcomes that we want are shared, and we believe that the areas that you're interested are in fixing are indeed in need of being fixing, the method to get there, we are far beyond that, I think, in the Oregon system, despite the problems that you have heard students discuss. But we believe that the criteria that needs to be evaluated here is an outcomes-based general education module, because only then will students be able to exit the system with a degree that means something in the state of Oregon and that all of the universities and the colleges in the state of Oregon agree upon. So the Joint Boards believes that we are closer now than we ever have been to achieving that goal, and we ask respectfully that this committee support our collaboration in the Oregon system and the Oregon institutions of higher ed, and let us develop that criteria. Let us come to you with a criteria for common course outcomes, because only then will the degree, the baccalaureate degree, mean something and that all students can support. The common course numbering it doesn't get there, because it doesn't matter what you name a course or what you number it. If we don't get to the common content, then it won't mean anything. And while Senator Schrader was concerned about students' transferability, that's not really the issue. Students who bring in credits from community colleges and Oregon University System colleges with more than 100 level courses, they're going to transfer, but the difference is whether you graduate with 180 credits or whether you graduate with 200 credits. They'll all transfer. What our proposal is, the Joint Boards Articulation Commission proposes that we have a common learning outcomes criteria for general education, first of all, and then secondly that the legislature approve and adopt and support the Oregon Atlas system, because then you have the facts and the data to determine just exactly how courses will transfer without sort of, borrowing Senator Cruz's words, dumbing down the system with common course numbering or names that don't get to the content, the core of the education that we are so desperately concerned about in terms of quality. So I would urge you to read the position paper. I won't read it, but the last paragraph asks that the recommendation of the Joint Boards asks that the state invest in the Atlas system. It's affordable. And simultaneously support collaboration among Oregon institutions of higher education as those institutions develop criteria for outcomes-based general education. This is the most comprehensive, affordable, and immediately actionable solution that we urge you to consider.
Thank you. That was quite a challenge to have to come up here after two of our esteemed colleagues and tell them, please let us do it on our own. But I appreciate that, and I believe Senator Schrader and Senator Courtney also do as well. And I think unless we ask some questions, we'll hear from three more of you out there who have some similar concerns. Thank you. I'm going to hear from Andrea Henderson and Ed Watson, and then we'll back clean up with Karen Sprague, Terry Rhodes, and Bob Turner. And if you can keep your testimony for 3 minutes, that would be appreciated.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon. I'll be very brief today and wanted to talk briefly about these two bills. We appreciate the efforts of both the senators in bringing these bills and certainly agree with the goals that they discussed in their testimony to you. We also would like to make sure that it works for our students and believe that more can be done to make it work for our students. And we do have two specific concerns with the bills as proposed. One, the timeline that is identified in the bills is not workable for us, in that essentially it would not be possible to make all those changes for this upcoming school year. Secondly, and more of greater concern, is the bill's proposed to create a common core system doesn't adequately address the issue at hand. And if the goal is really to make it better for students, there's other things that we can do that would have a larger payoff to make it work for our students. As you heard, there is some work that is being done, both with the Oregon Transfer Model, which is a very good step, but there is more work that needs to be done, and we would like to offer to work with members of the committee and both the senators that propose the legislation to bring back some amendments that we think can make it work for students in the future. With that, I would like to turn it over to Ed Watson, who is our vice president at Lynn Benton Community College.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Ed Watson from Lynn Benton Community College. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs, and I'm also will be the incoming chair of the Joint Boards Articulation Commission. I don't must have missed a meeting there, got nominated for that. Actually, over the past couple of years in my involvement with the JBAC, it has been exciting, and probably the most exciting part has been the development of our Oregon Transfer Module and the collaboration that we've seen between the sectors of community colleges and higher education. I do think the intent of the bills are worthy. I think the way to get to better transfer and articulation, there may be some unintended consequences if the bills were to go forth as they are. I do think that Common Core numbering might be seen as something that's quite standardized, but as many of us know and we've heard, we could transfer with similar course numbers, but the integrity of those courses may be significantly different. You heard mentioned today that Lynn Benton and Oregon State have a good dual enrollment program. Our students can be simultaneously enrolled in both institutions. The core of the success of that program, we do have close proximity and we've had a wonderful working relationship with OSU, but one of the key factors in that is that our core curriculum is aligned and the criteria of our lower division courses are aligned, not necessarily our course numbers. We have a variety of course numbers and course titles, but we know that when a student is taking classes within a distribution area or a cluster of classes in the arts and sciences or in the humanities and the arts, we have followed the course criteria that are represented in those courses, even if they have different names or numbers. Those courses are approved by our institutional curriculum approval process, and then they go on to Oregon State and they're approved as well. It really does simplify matters rather than complicate matters because we have an agreed upon set of outcomes and a set of course criteria. I do think it's a pattern that we could look at on a statewide basis without spending an inordinate amount of time trying to determine whether course numbers really do align with content. Frankly, transcript evaluation from courses coming from outside of the state are usually looked at based upon the content of those courses, not necessarily the numbers. So as I think we agree that the intent of the bills to improve transferability is agreed upon, we just think maybe the process and the way we go about that could be flawed.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. I appreciate it. Ms. Henderson, any questions from the committee? All right. Thank you both. I appreciate your input. Okay. We have about 10 minutes. I'll hear from Karen Sprague, Terry Rhodes, and Bob Turner. Sounds like a fan was shut off. I'm thinking, has it been the heat? Because we're freezing up here. All right. Introduce yourselves again, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Karen Sprague. I'm from the University of Oregon. And just to let you know that Terry Rhodes had to remove his name. He's had to go leave to teach a class.
Oh, all right.
I think the important points have been made. I think it's clear that all of us, Senator Schrader and Senator Courtney, are all trying to solve the same problem, and we simply differ in the most efficient ways to do that.
I think that Ed Watson has just given a good explanation for why an outcomes-based approach, although it may seem more complicated, is actually a simplification and is a useful way to tackle the problem. I think the demonstration has given an indication of the power of technology now to solve the rest of the problem. That is, it is possible now for students and advisors to not have to sit down with transcripts and large printed articulation tables and try to figure out what counts for what. Computers can do that and can give instant answers. So I think we're basically in agreement on the end goals here, and I look forward to working with you folks. I've already been in contact with Senator Schrader. We've been talking about his bill, and I look forward to continuing those interactions to solve the problem.
Thank you, Ms. Bray. And Mr. Turner, I'll grant you, let me waive this, you have legislative immunity in case the Senate President doesn't like what you have to say.
Senator Walker, members of your committee, thank you very much. I am Bob Turner. I am an associate professor in the biology department at Western Oregon University. I also direct the honors program, and as Senate President Courtney has already implied, I am the president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. And I apologize for the loss of voice. It is possible for me to agree with Senator Courtney, and I do in this particular case, though our goals are the same, and that is to make the ability of students to move from institution to institution within the Oregon University system and the community colleges, to make that an easy transition. As is frequently the case, my style is not the same as Senator Courtney's.
Nobody and says.
I thought that would probably be the case. I would ask your indulgence. This is what I've done to the first page of the sheet of material that I've given you, but I've decided to give it to you anyway because there are two points that I wish to make using the information on the back sides. The first is that the equivalent course numbering, as has been mentioned several times, is not going to accomplish the goal. On the back side of the first page, I've selected from the website for Lane Community College and for Western Oregon University just the titles of the Biology 101 courses. Biology 101 happens to be a course that is necessary for elementary education majors and for early childhood education majors at Western Oregon University. It should be apparent in examining the description of the courses that are offered at Lane Community College relative to those that are offered at Western that they are not the same with respect to their content. So even though the course number may transfer, it would not accomplish the educational goals of the student. I would also like to make the point that course content changes not just with the instructor but also with the perceived student population. And it is my explanation for the difference between those Biology 101 course contents is that they are intended to address different student populations, and that is, I think, a chief weakness in the legislation that has been offered. It will tend to eliminate the ability of institutions of higher education to address the populations of students that they confront. The second point that I wish to make is one that has been made repeatedly, and that is the both sides of the second page that I've given you that refer to the Oregon Health Science University School of Nursing. The School of Nursing at Oregon Health Sciences University requires that a student spend 2 years at another institution taking prerequisite classes. The School of Nursing has constructed a course matrix, or what's been referred to earlier as a transfer table, that tells a student exactly what courses they should take at any one of 24 different institutions in order to satisfy the course requirements at the School of Nursing. This, to me, is a hard copy of the intent of the articulation transfer linked audit system, which will turn this sheet of paper into a computerized system that every student will be spending Friday evenings during spring break using to examine the possibilities that they have in front of them. I believe I'll stop my comments at this point
except to add that the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate members are committed to working on constructing course tables, transfer tables, similar to the one that you have in front of you for the School of Nursing, which means that in each degree area, in each of the OUS institutions, a similar course table must be constructed, which does not now exist. We want to do that work. The reason we want to do that work is because we are concerned not just with the approximately 5,000 students who transfer, but also with meeting the needs of the diverse population represented by the 80,000 students already in the Oregon University system. And I thank you for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Any questions? I really appreciate your testimony. All the testimony today has been very good. The chart's very helpful. In trying to understand how that's so different. It's amazing how a biology 101 class can be so different from institution to institution. Senator Fruit.
Just a comment, and I would agree that the numbers are not the relevant thing. It's content that's relevant, but at the same time, you know, I can remember I took a class my senior year of high school in European history. It wasn't advanced placement back then. It was college prep is what it was called. And it was more in depth. I learned so much more than a level 200 class I took in college. And, you know, so there, I understand that the bills may have some problems, but and I would like to see something worked out, but I think this is important enough that it would be appropriate for the legislature to at least get behind the effort in some way, and I'm hoping that somehow we can come to some resolution so that we're putting something on the books that helps move in the direction.
Thank you, Senator. I know that when we first looked at these bills on the agenda, I just said, no, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. And then as I started learning about this system, I wanted to learn more, and I thought we all should learn more. And the presentation we got today was very informative. So I am going to have to talk to the two senators and see where they'd like to go from here, and we'll let you know. And thank you very much. The testimony today has been wonderful. I appreciate my committee staying late and staff as well, Don and Marjorie. We will adjourn until Wednesday. Thank you.